And a lot of the songs are just flat out happy songs, you know?
Yeah.
So fuck y'all. I was never like into Journey. And that was not something I appreciated.
Okay, interview's over. Yeah, so what was the Who with you? So you were a kid, you were at a Who concert and you got hit with a laser or something?
Well, that was a joke. I mean, that did happen.
Hey, this is Party Like a Rockstar podcast, and I'm your host, Joel. Today's episode is brought to you by Misha's Kind Foods. They're an LA-based small business making the world's finest non-dairy cheese on the market today. They're lactose-free, paleo, keto, kosher, perev, and 100% vegan. If you like what you see, check out the next video. If you like this video, please subscribe and like by clicking the little round button on the bottom right. To learn more about me or our other guests on the show, go to joelrody.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. The handle is Joel Rody. If you haven't already read my book, Memoir of a Rody, it's now available through Amazon in paperback, Kindle, or as an audiobook. I hope you enjoy the show. Victor DiLorenzo is the founding member of the band The Violent Femmes. He's also been an actor and filmmaker. He currently plays in the chamber rock duo 1913 with cellist Janet Schiff. And his newest project titled Night Crickets is with none other than David J. from Bauhaus. Mark Oliver Everett, better known as E, is the lead singer, songwriter, guitarist, keyboardist, and sometimes drummer of the rock band Eels. His new and 14th studio album, Extreme Witchcraft, is out now, and you should totally check it out. So I thought a fun way to start could be 1913 and what happened in the year 1913. So a few little things that came up in 1913 that I thought might be fun. Rosa Parks was born. The temperature in Death Valley, California hit 134 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 56.7 degrees Celsius, and is the highest in the U.S. Recorded history as of 2021. The Ford Motor Company starts production of the Model T on the assembly line in Detroit. And President Woodrow Wilson triggers the explosion of the Gamboa Dike, ending the construction of the Panama Canal. R.J. Reynolds introduced Camel, the first packaged cigarettes. And the last one is Louis Armstrong begins playing the cornet in the band of the New Orleans Home for Colored Waifs. So kind of fun. So,
you know, there was a lot of interesting artistic endeavor happening in Europe in the year 1913. Quite a lot of different things in the music world, also the visual world.
Is that why you chose the name for your band?
No, the reason why we chose the title 1913 for our duo is because Janet's cello was made in Transylvania in the year 1913.
That's kind of fun. That's cool. E, fascinated by your movie on your father. I was doing a little bit of diving on you, and your family background is interesting in that it was based on science, I guess might be a fair way to say, but your connection with your father, I know your lyrics, your albums are personal, which I think is what makes them so part of being so wonderful. But what triggered you to do the film on your dad?
Well, I wasn't triggered. It was the BBC's idea. They just came to me one day and said, would you mind if we followed you around with a camera crew for 2 weeks and tried to make you cry? And I thought, well, I'm always up for a challenge. And
but you wear glasses. Huh? You wear the glasses all the time. They could be like, they won't know you're crying.
Just looking for one single teardrop rolling on. They caught in the beard. You know, I didn't know what to expect. I had a lot of trepidation about it. And I did it, and I'm so glad I did it, because it was one of the great experiences of my life. To like, most of what I now know about my father came from that experience, getting to travel around and meet people that knew him well. And because he was, you know, somewhat of a impenetrable mystery to me in most ways, even though we grew up in the same house till he died when I was a teenager. He just never said much. You know, he was kind of the even by like old school 60s, 70s dad standards, he was extreme in the just, you know, closed off, distant dad thing.
So the, like the extra strong, silent type.
Yeah, not so strong, just silent.
Okay. I was going to say, I also saw that program and I thought it was fascinating. It was really wonderful. And for you to have that type of experience is just remarkable.
Well, that means a lot coming from you, Victor. I'm really honored to be here talking to you. You know, I lived through the 80s and didn't enjoy much of it, but one of the great, true original breath of fresh airs was the Violent Femmes. And, you know, thanks for making the 80s a lot more livable.
Oh, thank you so much. And I'd have to put out a thanks to my son, Malachi, for turning me on to the Eels music.
Oh, right.
Right. He was really into your music quite a bit.
Thank you, Malachi.
I must say that in the recent past, I haven't really been as up to date on your other records, but I'm certainly going to be looking into them.
You know, I'm happy anyone's listening to any of them. So
I feel the same. Please listen.
Yeah.
So the song Baby Genius, is it about your dad then, or?
Boy, that one's pretty far back. It's hard for me to remember what, I think so. Yeah, I think that was at least part of the inspiration to it. Yeah, because that album, that was from Electroshock Blues, which was, you know, heavily dealing with the tragedies of my family time.
It's an amazing album, man. It's seriously just incredible to listen to. I loved it.
Thank you.
Ah, it's a feather in the hat.
Well, it is like Albert Ayler said, music is the healing force of the universe.
Yeah, I believe that.
I really believe that.
Yeah.
That's what I was wondering too. I was going to ask as an addendum question, by going through the making of that film, documentary, what have you, it must have been very therapeutic for you in a lot of regards, I bet.
Yeah, completely. Like, yeah. Like I became a different person for the better as a result of it. I just, you know, I feel so lucky. I feel like everybody should be lucky enough to get to make a documentary about their father. You know, it's just a miracle. And, you know, the director of it, Louise from the BBC, is, you know, just a dear friend of mine ever since, because it was all her idea.
Mm. That's neat. I just think it's to have someone ask you to dip into your past is a compliment. It's interesting.
Yeah, the fact that anyone even cares, but it was particularly cathartic on behalf of my father, who wasn't recognized barely, you know, during his lifetime, and now, you know, every Marvel superhero movie is based on his theory. And, you know, I think he'd be loving seeing that things have caught up to him, you know?
Sure.
Yeah. I like the letter to Einstein I'd written here. It's like his way of saying you can kiss off into the sun. my little spin on things.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Victor, watching you perform is amazing. So I've seen a lot of bands play. I've been really fortunate. I did get to see you guys play one time. And where do you get all this energy?
I think I was born with it. But some of it is cultivated, of course. I always regarded my role in Violent Femmes as the manic drummer. So being an actor, first and foremost, that's how I got into this whole thing of show business. I was well aware at some point I had to assume some kind of a character within the confines of that trio. And I chose to go almost to the Keith Moon school of just manic energy and being unpredictable. Yeah. And that's something I think I mined that to great success, even though now it's funny that what I do now in most of the musical endeavor that I'm participating in, I'm anything but that. I'm a lot more, I wouldn't say serious, but I'm certainly a little bit more direct in my feelings and not really trying to project just one thing all the time, mm-hmm. which is kind of what I did with Violent Femmes, because I wanted to get something across in a very clear way.
What was that?
Well, just the idea of being a manic drummer and fulfilling that part in the whole pantheon of rock and roll.
Yeah.
You were really fun to watch.
So much fun to watch.
I had fun to play too. I mean, it was a great opportunity for me, until I think things got shut down a little bit. As everybody knows, once fame and money come into things, it changes the whole dynamic. So I was sometimes talked to about maybe not being so minstrel-like.
Oh.
So I had to put a damper on my performance a little bit. But I think in the beginning, the people that saw the original trio, it was really something different. And especially amidst everything else that was happening in the 80s, as far as rock music was concerned, we stuck out like a sore thumb.
Oh, you did. It was a good sore thumb, though. And so when you guys incorporate Gordon talking into the songs, I remember as a kid, I'm locked inside my house from the inside out or something is on the...
That one recording, right.
Yeah, and then...
That's an actual recording off of his family's phone machine.
So how did you... Was it a collective... I mean, because also in... Can I put in something like American Music, he says, and then... a little bit of talkie, and I don't know what, but that really... connected me to these songs as a high school student, actually, is when I first learned about you guys, and I loved how it was like talking to me, sort of. I wasn't used to that in music. So with the conversational aspects, whose idea was that? Is that a Gordon thing, or is that something you guys did, or collectively?
Well, that was part of the sound of Violent Femmes. We always described ourselves as folk punk. So in that way, we had the best of what we consider to be offerings from the folk world. A lot of storytelling in a song format. And I think just because of the kind of people that we were, Brian was open to new and interesting kinds of things that he hadn't been a part of up until that time. Gordon came from a modest theater background. I came from a total theater background and a lot of work as an actor.
Did you meet Gordon then through theater stuff, or?
No, I met Gordon through Brian, because Brian had seen him performing here in Milwaukee. And at this time, Brian and I had a rhythm section, which was called Violent Femmes.
Okay.
That was before we ever met Gordon. Our rhythm section for hire was called Violent Femmes. And one day Brian came to rehearsal and said, "Hey, I met this pint-sized Lou Reed imitator last night. And I think we should maybe get together with him and make some music." And I said, "Okay, let's go see him." So I met Gordon then, and then we decided to play some music together. And we were only going to play together through the summer. And then Brian and I had designs on moving up to Minneapolis and forming a band with some friends of mine up there. Oh. But the Femmes, the enigma of the Femmes, it just took off so fast that I didn't have a chance to go up to Minneapolis, and we just stayed in Milwaukee and continued our journey there.
And then you guys were discovered, I guess you could say. So you were playing outside of a venue, and then you were dragged into play. Is that how it
The Chrissy Hynde story?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if that's really a discovery story. I mean, it makes for a nice story.
Yeah.
Almost like a Schwab's drugstore, kind of a Hollywood story. Yeah. In that we were just playing underneath the marquee with our acoustic instruments, and the Pretenders were playing that night in this theater called the Oriental Theater. And during a break from their sound check, they came out and they were listening to us for a while. And we had finished a song called Girl Trouble, which had the great refrain, "Girl Trouble, I've got girl trouble up my ass." And Chrissy Hynde just lost it. She just loved that song. So she came up to us after we had a little break and she said, "Excuse me, my name's Chris. We're playing here tonight. Do you want to play with us?"
See, he is a great actor. You see that, E?
We said, "Sure. Well, we'd love to play with you. Is this your band, The Pretenders?" Because we didn't know anything about The Pretenders. And she said, "Yeah, that's our band. And if you want to come and play, you can play three songs. You're welcome to have anything to drink or eat backstage. Stay and see the show. But but we can't pay you anything. And we said, yeah, that sounds fine. So it's funny, until this day, I'll meet people that say that they were at that show and that they loved it. But when we played that show, we only played three songs, and it wasn't the best reception when we started. I think by the time we finished the three songs, we had maybe 50% of the audience with us. But at first it was like, hey, get these fucking farmers off the stage. What are they doing there? You know, we don't want to hear this shit. And but we persevered and got through it. But why I say it wasn't really a discovery kind of a thing is that the next day we were just back busking on the street again, like nothing had ever happened. So the real discovery for the Violent Femmes happened some months later when we went to New York and opened a show for Richard Hell and the Voidoids at the Bottom Line. And in the New York Times, there was a review that spent maybe one paragraph on Richard Hell, and the other seven were about us. So that was our introduction to the whole fame game.
When you got going, were you nervous about having such personal content? Is it sometimes difficult to play those songs live? Or
I have this, you know, thing when I'm writing songs that I don't have any filter on, and it doesn't occur to me when I'm, you know, I'm just trying to, you know, get to the heart of the matter and be as real as possible. And it's not until either the awkward part comes when I got to sing the vocal in front of the other guys in the studio for the first time. That's when it starts to hit me. Oh God, what have I done? Yeah. Yeah, but the band dudes tend to be, you know, dudes, and you know, I'm the one writing all the lyrics, and you know, I'm kind of the odd man out in the group at that point, so it always feels like really vulnerable and awkward at that point. And then also sometimes the first time you sing a song live, you can have similar feelings, and it gets easier. Especially if people embrace the song, then it's like, okay, no sweat, you know, and then it becomes cathartic and you're glad you went through it all.
How did the Steve Perry thing come about? Did he go to a bunch of your shows? Did you know he was a big fan? Are you friends with him? Or I say were, like, I just assume it was done.
No, we are good friends now. And it was a long road. I was never like into Journey. You know, that was not something I appreciated.
Okay, interview's over.
Like in my teens or whatever, it just wasn't my cup of tea, you know.
Fair enough.
I was more of a Violent Femmes guy.
Oh, there you go. Now he's kissing butt. Okay.
So I had heard that he'd been coming to our shows. I don't know how he got into us, but I gotten a couple of reports like Steve Perry's in the audience over the years, pretty far back. And I was like, whatever, you know, I didn't care. I was like, oh, that's nice, you know. And then it got back to me, like backstage at some point, that he wanted to come backstage, and I said no. I look back on that now, I was like, I was a dick. You know, I can't even say hi to Steve Perry, even if I didn't appreciate Journey at the time.
Right.
So then another year went by, and our lighting guy came backstage and said, Steve Perry's in the audience again, and I got to tell you what he just did. I went up to him and I said, excuse me, Mr. Perry, my girlfriend is a huge fan of yours. And before he could say anything else, Steve stood up and said, let's call her. And I was like, oh, what a great guy. Bring him back.
Yeah.
I met him and he was really nice. And at the time, I had a long-standing croquet game in my backyard every Sunday religiously for like 10 years.
Wonderful.
And I just thought, you know, Steve might be a fun croquet player. So we invited him over, and he became like a regular part of our croquet crew. And then he started showing up unannounced to our tour rehearsals one year. He would show up like, you know, many of the days, he would just show up and he would just sit there and watch us play. And once in a while, Chet, my guitarist, who did grow up a big Journey fan, would try to bait Steve and sort of play the intro to a Journey song. And we were hoping he'd get up and sing, but he would never take the bait. He would just laugh. You know, they play one of your songs, you know. And this went on for a couple of years of touring.
A couple of years?
Yeah, like, you know, when, like the next time we had a tour. And then one year, he showed up the first day of our tour rehearsals carrying his own microphone. And I thought, what? Is he finally ready?
Was it like in a golden box?
No, just in his hand, very unpretentious. And then this time, Chet started playing a Journey song, and Steve took the bait and he stood up and he sang. Like, as far as I remember, it was like the first time he sang a Journey song in, you know, 20 years or something.
Jeez.
And I had to say, like, at that moment, I became a Journey fan because I was getting just like, you know, the hair on the back of my neck was standing up, and his voice sounded the same, and it was just like, oh my God, you know. And it was just like, from a human interest angle, it was
sure
a beautiful moment where he was finally ready to just do what he does, you know. And
yeah, that he had to take the time to work up that courage.
I think and then he said, you know, he did it a few more times, and he sang some of my songs, which was really a big thrill.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, I think I'm going to come out and do a show with you guys somewhere. Because I had brought it up a few times, you know, previously, and he was always like, nah. And I said, you know, just come out and, you know, during an encore somewhere, you know. And for some reason, he picked St. Paul. I don't know why. He said, I'm going to come to St. Paul. And he did. And he was there. And he came out, and it was his first live performance in 30 years or something.
And I bet people were in shock.
Well, everybody thought I was joking because it was such a non sequitur, because nobody knows about at the time knew about this history of me and Steve being friends. And it was just very strange at the end of an Eels concert for me to come out and say, I'm going to bring out someone now, and blah, 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 ladies and gentlemen, Steve Perry. And everyone's kind of like, it's a gag, you know, a Steve Perry impersonator is going to come out or something. And then he came out and everyone was just like, and it was a great magic moment.
And then did Mark, did he do one of your songs then, or did he?
He started, I think, by doing one of my songs.
Okay.
And then then he delivered the goods and two or three of his song of old Journey songs.
That's a great story.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It's all on YouTube, and it's really. And then he did a couple more shows on that tour with us too. He showed up in, I think, Washington D.C. and L.A.
So what happened after the show? Were you guys in the bus and you're just like, dude, that was amazing? And he was kind of like, I know.
No, he was happy. I was worried, you know, like, because he'd had such trepidation about doing it for so long, he seemed like he was in really high spirits afterwards. It was great.
It's perfect thing. That's exactly how you want it. Cause it's gotta be you gotta be really nervous. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of expectation for sure.
Yeah.
You hope you got it.
I've got a similar story I can throw into the pot here.
Yeah.
I can't remember the exact year, but Violent Femmes were in Phoenix. And I had heard through Brian that Mo Tucker's daughter, Carrie, was a Femmes fan, and she was going to try to come to the show and bring her mom. So I said, Brian, are you serious? He goes, yeah, I've been in contact with her, and she's going to try to make this happen. And I said, okay. So we're in Phoenix at the hotel, actually more of a motel, just a cheap motel. And there's a knock on my door, and I open the door, and there, standing, is Mo Tucker with a six-pack under her arm. And I'm looking at her, and I'm going, wait, you're Mo Tucker? And she said, I hope you're Victor, right? And I said, yeah, I'm Victor. Why don't you come on in? So she came in, and I guess her daughter had gone out somewhere shopping or something. So she was just by herself, which I thought was really gutsy to come and just introduce herself.
Yeah.
But we just had a great time. We had just shared a few beers and we're talking. And then right away, of course, my mind is going, okay, I got to get Mo Tucker to sit in with the Femmes tonight. How do I make this happen? So I started plying her with little baby questions here and there, talking about when's the last time you played live, and have you played drums lately? Are you just playing guitar a lot in your band, or what are you doing? So finally we get there, and the show is taking place at a boxing club, and the band, swear to God, we're set up in the ring. We're in the boxing ring. So while I'm playing, I could also run around the ring and throw myself off the turnbuckles and stuff, and pretend like it's big time wrestling, right? So anyway, I get to the point in the show where we have a little, kind of like a little break. There's like a little intro. And I went over to Mo, she's at the side of the stage. I said, come on, Mo, come on out. I'll let you play the floor tom. I'll give you some sticks you can play. No, I don't think, I said, come on, just come and play. So she goes, okay. And she just ran out. I gave her the stick. She started playing that floor tom. I was playing the snare, and it just sounded great. We just had
so neat.
Just a great time. And then from that time on, we were just really good friends. And I did some recording with her. And I was the drummer on the last tour that she did with Sterling before Sterling died. I was the drummer, and what was playing guitar, and we were doing mostly her material and some Velvet stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, but so cool. Great lady, wonderful lady. And man, when she hits that drum, she's hitting that drum.
I bet she had some good stories.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
She would tell us these stories about Lou that, quite frankly, just made me really sad. Because I knew Lou a little bit, and I witnessed him being a jackass, and I've also witnessed him being very, very nice. Mm. But yeah, Mo had some stories, especially around the time of when they got back together to do the reunion, and how Lou kind of took over everything and spoiled it from them going further because he wanted to control every aspect of everything. Mm-hmm. And then of course, you know, the pay equity, just, it wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of sad hearing some of those stories.
Yeah. What songs do you guys have in your catalog that you say should have been a hit, damn it?
All of them.
Right answer.
Fair enough. Yeah, all right. Why did you?
I don't know. I'm looking at a few different catalogs, so I don't know what I would say. If I would say the Femmes, well, we had some pseudo hits, I guess.
You guys had total hits.
You guys had huge hits.
You
think so?
You guys had legit hits. Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I mean, like, with now people listening,
Blister is always the one people talk about. Oh, but American, I suppose we did have hits with a couple cover versions, one of Do You Really Want to Hurt Me?
And Crazy. So why did you guys choose those?
Well, I didn't do Crazy with them. That was after I was out of the
band. Oh, was it? Okay.
But we had another cover of Children of the Revolution. And it's great in that both those instances, the children of the people that made those songs famous told us, well, except for Boy George, he told us directly that he thought our cover was the best that was ever done of his song.
Yeah.
And then Roland Bolin said that he thought our cover of Children was the best interpretation of one of his dad's songs. So that made us feel great.
Wow.
Yeah, that's great stuff. Let's see here. Daniel Johnston. I love Daniel Johnston. So both of you guys are fans, I presume. Oh yeah, nutty guy. I was actually in touch with him. We were gonna do a graphic novel together. If I don't know how well you knew him, but his brother was his manager. So his brother and I were chatting, and Daniel actually started drafting out some of the stuff, but he wanted to change the storyline, and I'm like, that's fine. So his brother's like, no, it's not fine. And I'm like, no, it's fine. Just get him to keep drawing. And we ended up sandbagging the project because his brother said it's just too big of a task and it's not going to work out. But yeah, it was a bummer. But I found out about him because of the documentary they had done, and that was so well done. It was such a great project.
Yeah, it just breaks your heart.
It is. It's sad. But at the same time, I'm glad that he wrote the stuff he wrote, and the covers of his songs, I love some of them. They're fantastic.
Why do you think Sadness and Turmoil has prompted some of the best artwork?
I think it's that when you're going through extreme emotion, you have an outpouring, and that outpouring is easier, I think. I actually think it's impressive when people write happy music sometimes, because I don't know how you could write something. They have to be simple. That can be really hard.
Yeah, that's the harder thing to do for sure, is to write a meaningful happy song.
Right.
And I think, you know, the bummer songs they're so vital, because it's such a lifeline, you know, to the person writing it. It's like you're just like desperate to communicate something.
And then I think, though, the recipient, the listener, has the same idea, where they can connect to it because they have had those same emotions and feelings. Whereas if you're like, oh, it was just a great day and I was having a fun time, they're like, ah, whatever. Get that all the time.
Right.
But I've known people who specifically have to be down in order to get something done, which I always found fascinating, but also very frightening, because in my experience, working either in theater or in music or film or what have you, I like to be pretty well adjusted and feel as though, not outright joyful, but at least pretty stable and happy. I don't need to get myself in a fit to be able to write something that I think is pertinent to me.
Mm-hmm.
But some people really need that as a prompt.
Yeah,
I know he likes to stand on his head naked in the shower when he writes all of his music. Read it online.
It must be true then.
That must be true. What were you going to say? I'm sure it was more profound than my shower joke.
I agree with Victor. I don't feel like I have to be down. You know, I think I get pigeonholed a lot for like being the bummer rock guy. And but I think if anyone's paying attention, it's almost always in the name of getting to a brighter place. Mm-hmm. And that's always the point. And usually, you know, very often there's arcs to our albums, you know, that's leading to a brighter place. And a lot of the songs are just flat out happy songs, you know?
Yeah.
So fuck y'all.
And, you know, and some people don't really recognize satire anymore. They don't understand it. Everybody is so literal in this day and age. Mm-hmm. And it's because of the fucking internet.
Yeah, you can't win, because like either I am being satirical and people don't understand it, or I'm not and they think it's satirical.
Right. You're caught coming and going.
Yeah,
right.
Damned if you don't.
So a fun one. I was putting together this podcast, and I'm in the age where most of my friends have little kids now. And so my friend's daughter is in fifth grade and her little girlfriends were over, and collectively they said, I should ask every guest when they first felt famous. So my question to each of you is, when did you first feel famous? If you don't want to go down the road of saying fame, when was there a time in your career that was a pivotal, monumental, something happened that meant something to you, an event that's worth repeating? What would you
mean that was tied to bona fide fame, or just fame in your mind?
It could be wherever you take it. Yeah, there's been,
because I'd have two different answers.
Okay, give us both, please.
I would say the first time I felt famous was when I got it together enough to write a little skit that I could present to my parents in the living room, and that's when I was totally into the idea of growing up to be a famous actor.
What was the skit about?
The skit was about trying to make lunch for school, trying to get something together in the kitchen.
Was it humor-based?
I wasn't having a good go at it. Yeah, things were going bad. That was part of the skit. That's and great. After I was done with that, I got some laughs out of my parents, and I figured I was famous then, or at least that was my initial feeling of what fame could be like.
So you were like 30 years old, or?
No, I think I was probably about 10 years old. Which is also the time when I got my first tape recorder.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, my father had a barber friend. He was a barber also. And this guy just had a knack for gadgets. And one day he came over with this Ayla tape recorder I was 9 years old. And I was very interested in it. So my father bought it for me. And from that point on, I just started recording stuff off of television. I can remember recording like the theme from Mission Impossible.
I used to do that too.
Yeah, did you do that too?
Yeah, I used to record whole episodes of Monty Python on a little crappy reel-to-reel I got at a garage sale.
Right.
And then just play it back. This is like before VCRs, I guess. So it was the only way you could replay it was just listen to the audio.
Right. Yeah, and I was just totally jazzed by that. And that started me off on my other part of my career as an engineer. So, because I've been engineering and I've had a commercial recording studio for over 30 years.
Wow.
That's where I am right now. This is the downstairs. Upstairs is the real studio, and it's called the Past Office.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm upstairs in the control room of my studio right now.
Yeah, your place looks beautiful. I've been looking at it.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, no, I really like the shape of the room.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was the attic.
So, yeah. Yeah. That's where mine is in an attic as well.
Yeah.
It's neat.
So what about you, Ian, as far as fame?
Well, I am so barely famous. It's not something that enters into my daily life unless, you know, if I'm on tour, you know, or if I'm, you know, back in the days when there was record stores, if I was in a record store, maybe, you know, or something. But the rest of the time, I'm just, you know, a guy on the street for the most part. But then when I do encounter someone who knows who I am, it's quite often intense. So it's a strange phenomenon. And I have a four-year-old little boy now who is trying to come to grips with my small amount of fame. Recently, when our latest album came out, there was billboards up around town advertising it, and you know, with a big like psychedelic picture of me, the album cover. And him and his mom drove by it one day, and and he said, "Wait, is Dada famous or something?" Yeah, or something is more on the
or something.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really funny.
It's cute.
That reminds me of when my son was really young, he was in a predicament because he would say to me, "Dad, I'm not sure if I should be a sports guy or a concert guy." That's what he thought of me, a concert guy, because he would see me play concerts and stuff.
Right.
So, yeah, it's funny. And now it was just his birthday the other day, and he's 39.
Wow.
Yeah.
You play the drums?
Very well. He plays with this fellow named Langhorn Slim.
Okay.
He's a drummer for Langhorn.
Concert guy.
Pardon me?
He's a concert guy.
He is a concert guy, but he does play soccer on the weekends.
Oh, he's both.
Best of both worlds. It's not quite croquet, but hey, you know, to start.
Yeah, so he got sucked into the music world too. I tried to get him out of it, but I couldn't dissuade him.
Yeah. All you can do is try.
Right. But all my kids have some kind of musical thing going on, so.
How many kids do you have?
I've got three. I've got two daughters and a son.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah.
So another fun one is gigs. What are the, like playing in a wrestling ring is a fun one. That's good. I like that picture. That was a good one. But what other gigs have you guys had that come to mind that are just kind of, where are we and how are we playing here? Who was responsible for booking this? Or
there's been a lot of those over the years.
Oh, good. God, I know.
I tend to like want to block out those experiences, so it's hard to recall them.
Right. I can remember one time being in Europe somewhere, and I don't know if the band was Rat. I can't quite recall the name of the band, but they were on before us in this venue, one of those weird European venues where you're not really sure what it is. And I remember we were showing up to do a sound check, and there were these big skulls on stage. They hadn't removed the skulls yet. And then on the floor was all these pieces of ground beef. For some reason, they were throwing meat all over the stage or something, and it was just,
wow.
What?
It was horrible. Bad.
Yeah, that's a weird
one. I don't know why that just came to mind.
That would be a hard one to top.
Yeah, that's a weird one.
The way it sounded walking on the meat wasn't good.
Got anything worse than that? Right? Mark, I don't know. That is a weird one.
That's no,
weird one.
I can't top the meat.
The meat. All right. Your father had a distressed in Western medicine. And why do you think, as a guy who's so highly educated, so smart, do you think that was a time and era thing? Have you never thought about it? Or
I don't know if he had a distrust in it as much as just a disinterest in caring about his health. You know, he was just kind of hell bent on, I work hard, so I'm going to play hard kind of thing, I guess, you know.
And did you do photography too a lot? Because I have here they did photography. He did photography with his father, or you did photography with him? Or
I didn't, but my father did do photography. He won some photography awards when he was, you know, like a teenager in his 20s, I think. Yeah.
So do you think there was an embrace to an artistic career within your parents for you?
They were maybe to a fault so hands off. Not really to a fault. I shouldn't say that because I'm happy with the way things turned out. But sorry, my dogs are invading. they didn't give me any direction either way. They just let me figure it out. And luckily I went to our next door neighbor's garage sale when I was six, and they had a toy drum set for $15 that I was immediately in love with. And my parents gave me the $15. And unfortunately for them, you know, most kids would play them for a few days and lose interest, but I played them in the house every day for 10 years. Completely dedicated to the cause.
That's great.
That's great. So you started off as a drummer.
Yeah, that's all I was for a long time. And I became, I have to say, I was a good drummer at a very young age. Like at the age of six, I played, maybe this is my first real taste of fame, was I played at the first grade talent show.
Yeah.
And all it was a record player with the Star Spangled Banner playing on the record. And I just played trap drums to it somehow. I think really all it is a snare roll, you know. Yeah. But I did like some crazy Keith Moon version of the Star Spangled Banner, and it brought the cafeteria down. Like, I was a star at that moment.
There you go. Right.
You know, I was like, I want more of that.
Yeah. Fame took its first bite out of you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's funny. My first instrument was a viola. That's what I started playing.
Wow. Yeah.
The only reason I started playing drum set was because my cousin had a friend that was going to Vietnam and wanted to sell this drum set. So my cousin asked me if I knew someone that would want to buy it. And at that point in time, I was working a job at a Holiday Inn in Racine, Wisconsin, where I grew up. And I was washing dishes and helping the janitor and stuff. So I had some money in my pocket. And I figured, well, I suppose I could help this guy out. I really didn't have any inkling to want to play drums. I just figured I would help this guy out. So wow. $350 was a beautiful four-piece Slingerland set with cymbals, nice old cymbals. I wish I still had them. And I just had the drum set sitting in my parents' basement for like 2 weeks. I would come home from school and I'd look at it and I'd just go in my room. So I figured I got to get a drummer over here that can show me how to set it up. I didn't know how to set it up or anything. So I had a drummer come over and show me how to set it up. And then the usual thing, playing to records. And then I got serious and I started studying with a fellow who was a big band drummer in Chicago in the 40s, a guy named Joe Police, really good drummer. And he taught me how to read rhythmic notation and made me fall in love with the brushes, jazz brush playing. And I used that jazz brush playing and bastardized it to play in Violent Femmes. That's how that all came about. But yeah, I wasn't really even interested in the drums at first. It was just something to help someone else out.
Interesting, because I was all about drums.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, and then eventually I studied with other drummers, and especially a guy named Telly Lesbines, and he was the chief timpanist in the Milwaukee Symphony. Yeah. So I studied with him for a while, classical percussion. Mm. But I also had a jazz drummer friend of mine that I studied with too.
You know, do you think as a whole, the Violent Femmes music is just so much fun for me to listen to? I think that's why I have, you know, my Spotify list. I have so much of your catalog saved because I like so much of your music. Do you think you were having a lot of fun when you look back at it in general?
Was it having fun?
Yeah. Was it all a great time? Was it enjoyable?
Yeah, it was very enjoyable up to a certain point. But up until that point, I was on top of the world. I was doing exactly what I always had wanted to do, which was to be some kind of a performer touring the world. And that's what I was doing. So I was more than happy. But when the human interference started to show up, that's when it got to be a little bit of a challenge. And when you start feeling as though the other people you're on the journey with, that you can't really figure out what they're thinking anymore, that's when you start to get frightened. And that was what happened to me. Because for the longest time, we were all on the same page, but then it just started to deteriorate. And for a number of different reasons, and I certainly contributed to the deterioration. I wasn't any angel myself. But I'd have to say, looking at the whole career, we were shot so many times in the foot by what Brian and Gordon did. It's just really sad because I can think in my mind of what it could be, what it had the potential to be, but then it just got cut off at a certain point.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah. There's a lot of years though too, and you also fight with your, you know, you're living together, you're touring together, you're eating and drinking and living everything together. You would argue with your brothers and sisters at home too. Mm-hmm. So I think there's some of that what people don't necessarily understand is there's a little more to it than just writing songs together. So
right, and it's how you grow into being an adult. And the three of us were certainly very different individuals. We came together to make this noise, Violent Femmes, but beyond that, we couldn't have been more different, the three of us.
Hmm. Yeah.
And it's funny how that always seems to work that way, huh?
Yeah, like the Who, like they all hated each other and yet kept it going for so long. It's amazing.
Separate tour buses.
Yeah.
For starters, I don't know.
A lot of money.
Yeah, so what was the Who with you? So you were a kid, you were at a Who concert and you got hit with a laser or something?
Well, that was a joke. That did happen. I was lucky enough to have a sister who was 6 years older than me when I was a kid, and she took me to so many amazing concerts, and she took me to a Who concert. This is, you know, while Keith Moon was still alive. And the laser did hit me in the eyes, but it didn't do anything. But I've been lucky enough to become friendly with Pete Townsend. He asked me to write liner notes for a live thing they put out. And I just put that in as a joke that, you know, all is forgiven, even though I was blinded and had to wear glasses ever since then.
you're all ready to be in a stage production of Tommy.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's going too far.
Hey, Mark, do you remember the first show you went to?
Yes.
It
was an obscure artist named George Harrison.
Oh.
And it was not only, you know, the first time I'd been in the same room with a Beatle, it was the first ever concert I'd been to. You know, I was in sixth grade. I was like 11.
Wow.
And Billy Preston was part of it. And it was... Yeah. You know, Jim Keltner playing drums, and you know, this was his 1974 tour that was really panned by the critics because his voice was shot, and I think
the Dark Horse tour. Yeah.
Yeah, I think he was really coked up or whatever, and he wasn't in great shape. But like, you know, none of that mattered to me. It was just, oh, like, yeah, you know, my God, you know, I'm hearing a Beatle play. And just, and also just, it could have been anybody, and it would have been amazing just to, you know, be in an arena hearing loud music playing, you know, and then the fact that it was, you know, George Harrison was amazing.
Yeah. My first experience other than seeing the polka band at the church social was, which I was really influenced by, as a matter of fact, there was this guy named Rocky Lapatina, and he played clarinet, and they would do all the, you know, like Italian tarantellas and weird kinds of popular music of the day and stuff. But he was really funny that he was a character, and he was a small kind of a rotund guy, and he would play this clarinet, and he would dance around, and he would come down to the lip of the stage, and the little kids would come up there, and they'd be just so excited that they're right by the stage by him. And then he'd reach in his pocket and he'd pull out this fake spider and just scare these kids with the spider.
Wow.
And I was thinking, all right, there's my start in show business, a little bit of heaven, a little bit of hell right there. It's all happening. So I had that, but my first concert experience was Madison, Wisconsin. Oh God, probably 1970. And I saw Frank Zappa and the Mothers with Flo and Eddie.
Oh, wow.
Oh, great. Yeah.
It was fantastic. It was just fantastic. But that's the first time I was around like a lot of hippies smoking pot.
Yeah.
Just that whole deal. And I was just so young and I'm just soaking it all up. And
I think the show that Poison did with you that I remember that I was there, I think Flo and Eddie performed at that.
Was I in the band at that time? I don't remember ever playing with Poison. Was I?
It was in 2001. It was the Glam Slam Summer Jam.
Oh, it's like a big outdoor thing.
Yeah, it was an outdoor thing. So,
okay.
But I think Flo and Eddie played.
Was it in California?
No, it was. I think it might have been in Wisconsin because I might be wrong here, but I kind of remember like you guys getting into a station wagon and driving off, but it might have been Flo and Eddie and not you. I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't really remember that playing with Poison. That sounds like a weird bill though.
You would remember that.
I was so happy I remember because it was just some, you know, it was something other than the same stuff we heard every day. So the Turtles, the Flo and Eddie guys were fantastic to watch. They're really, really good.
Yeah.
And then you guys
too. They were great musicians.
They're great still musicians. Are. And then I remember you guys hanging out, or the bass player from your band was hanging out a lot of the day. And again, just something different. Like, oh boy, this is going to be so nice to hear something other than 80s rock and roll from Poison and the other hair metal guys. And I don't know, not knocking them, but in my book, I make light of, I said I shave my head every day and revolt against the long hairs. I couldn't handle the Poison songs, but now I'm totally bald. So everybody got their joke back. I think, I don't know, it's kind of, anyway. Well, I do appreciate your guys' time. You know, if there's anything else you want to say, please do so. If you have any questions for each other, but other than that, you know, thank you.
Well, I don't know, E. What do you think? I know I want to come visit your studio next time I'm in LA.
Oh yeah, yeah. Come on, there's not a lot to it. It's not very big, but yeah.
I'll come play some drums for you.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be cool.
Yeah. I was just in LA doing a video for this. I don't know if you know about this, but I have this new band called Night Crickets with David J from Bauhaus playing bass. And this other guy, Darwin Miners, who's a musician from San Francisco, kind of a guy that plays all kinds of different things. But we just released a new record called A Free Society on Omnivore Recordings. And I was just in LA 4 days ago doing a video for the album. But I think I might be coming back in July, so I'll see if I can get together with you or something.
It gets pretty hot up here in the attic in July, but I'll crank.
Well, we can always meet somewhere else.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Cool.
Thanks for watching. Don't forget to like and subscribe by clicking the round button on the bottom right. To learn more about me or the guests on the show, go to joelrody.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. The handle's Joel Rody. And don't forget, when you party like a rock star, don't be a dick.